In this podcast episode, I want to talk about 5 inner work practices that have changed my life personally. These are tools that I have used that have made me go like, wow, change really can happen pretty quickly. You actually can shift your mindset in a pretty short span of time, which is something that I only started believing once I put these tools into practice. I went to therapy. It didn't really do it for me. I've read the mindset self-help books like the You Are a Badass by Jen Sincero. Didn't do it for me. And if you're in that same boat, but you are like me and you're like, well, I want to do inner work. Like I want to work on my mindset, whatever that means. I want to feel good. These are some practices and tools that you can implement into your life like pretty immediately. That at least for me, whenever I do them, I experience shifts. Or at least 80% of the time when I do these things, I'm like, oh, damn. Change is happening. Starting with tool number 1. So I'll tell a story about the author of the book Little Treatments, Big Effects. Her name is Jessica Schleider, and she was in treatment for an eating disorder for years. At 23, she relapsed and she enrolled herself in a program where she would have 3 hours of therapy every single day. And 2 months into that, she ate one of her fear foods. So fear foods are foods that you feel a strong aversion towards that make you anxious or that you just go out of your way to avoid. And after she ate this fear food, her fellow patient turned to her and was like, hey, like what made you eat your fear food today? Like what was different about today that got you to do it? And she responded and she was like, well, I usually don't try my fear foods until I feel ready, but I figured, you know, I'm actually probably never going to feel ready to eat this fear food. It's not going to happen on its own. So I just did it. And that person responded to her and they were like, well, I mean, what if that's the whole thing? And Jessica was like, what do you mean? Like doing hard stuff, even though you're not feeling ready is the whole thing. And the other person was like, yeah, exactly. Like what if just every morning you decided to wake up and do the stuff that's hard, to eat the thing that's scary, to do the stuff that feels uncomfortable, even if you aren't sure that you can, even if it feels really difficult and scary, like what if that is the answer? And Jessica was kind of annoyed by this because she was like, well, it's not that simple. And then this conversation just kept on replaying in her mind and she was like, wait, what if it is that simple? What if I'm just so attached to my identity of someone that struggles with these issues to the point where I've been too scared to actually try just doing hard things in order to recover from this disorder? What if I really try to just give daily hard choices a go? Suddenly, her whole inner monologue started to change around this. At any moment, she realized that she could take action to recover. Even if she didn't feel like it. It was one very tiny conversation. And obviously, like that conversation on its own was not what led to her recovery. There were many different things in the road, but she remembered that conversation so vividly because it was such a turning point for her. And for another person, it may not have been a turning point, but for her, it was one small moment that shifted her thinking like immediately. More than years of some therapy had. When I first heard this story, it was on a podcast and I'll link that down in the description below. It resonated with me so much. I've never struggled with an eating disorder, but I have had those little conversations where one tiny thing will be said or I will have one tiny little insight that will completely shift things for me. And a lot of those insights have been sparked by the things I'll talk about in this video, starting with thinking sessions. So thinking sessions is actually probably the very first, maybe inner work tool that I started using when I was like, I want to do the mindset work, but I don't know where to start. And it's from a book called Time to Think by Nancy Klein. I can remember the first time I did a thinking session. I did it with my sister. I was in her office. And at the end of the thinking session, I actually remember like turning to her and being like, Amy, that is what I thought that therapy was supposed to feel like. I don't want to rag on any therapist here. I know I have some therapists in my audience. I think it's just down to the quality of the therapist and the relationship you have with the therapist. And I just haven't had both of those things align. And having this thinking session was what convinced me that like change truly can happen in a moment. Changes in your thinking can happen in very short periods of time when you have the right inner work tools. So a thinking session is something that you usually do with a partner. So you want to have someone else in your life that you can do this with. But honestly, also you can do this with ChatGPT. Nancy Klein, who wrote the book, would probably say it's not going to be as good of a quality of a thinking session. But I've had pretty good results using ChatGPT, the voice function, talking back and forth. I've just instructed it on how to do a thinking session and it's helped me. So let's run through what the steps are of how to run a thinking session. Firstly, you've got your thinking partner. And to your thinking partner, you want to name your very top struggle. So maybe you feel disconnected from your friends. Maybe you feel like your business is flopping, whatever. Step number 2, have your thinking partner ask, what do you want to think, feel or say when it comes to this struggle. And you really just want to verbally vomit all of your thoughts and feelings about this struggle. The way that I see it, it's like running a tap. At the start, you're just getting out the dirty water. And whenever you come to a lull in this conversation, you want your thinking partner to ask you, you know, what more do you have to think, feel, or say until you truly have nothing left to say? Step number four, have your thinking partner ask you, what do you want to think, feel, or be able to say, do after this thinking session? Another way to put this is from Little Treatments, Big Effects, the book. Imagine you are sleeping and a miracle occurs. You wake up and your problem is solved. What changes are there in your thinking? How are you behaving differently? What would it be easier for you to do? Step number five, have your thinking partner then ask, what are you assuming that is stopping you from creating this reality or these changes? Get them to keep on asking this question. You want to come up with all the assumptions that you can. Step number six, what is a true and liberating alternative assumption? So you want to think of like a positive opposite to your assumption. So for example, if you're assuming like, it's impossible for me to get good at this job, a positive opposite could be, I could actually get pretty good at this job pretty easily because I'm super capable. And then your last step, you want your thinking partner to ask you, imagine if you knew that that liberating assumption was true. Like just imagine, put yourself in a world where that liberating assumption is true. And you can do this in the same way that you can put yourself into a movie or you can put yourself into a character's shoes in a book. It's truly about being able to use your imagination. How would you feel about this struggle now? What might you do differently? I've definitely glazed over these steps. I would recommend getting the book Time to Think for a very in-depth look at these steps and how to do them. I have also adjusted it over time to suit my own needs, but this simple little process has brought about absolute revelations for me. Tool number two. So there was this English actor, Alastair Sim, the guy who played Ebenezer Scrooge in the most beloved version of A Christmas Carol. One day he just came to this funny conclusion about himself. He decided formally that he was a fool. And when he made this decision in his mind and when he just went, I own it, like I am a fool, it was like a weight lifted off of him. Suddenly he felt all this energy flowing through him. He just felt like he was free. And more importantly, he could focus on what mattered to him, which was the art and discipline of acting. He felt like once he knew he was a fool and he just owned being a fool, he didn't feel like this need to be clever. He could be what he thought himself to be, which was the fool that he thought he was. Of course, then he went on to become a great English actor. This was all before his success. So what you've just heard is actually shadow work. I don't know that Alastair Sim knew he was doing shadow work. I'm probably not, but he was doing shadow work. And this actually sounds like the opposite of what every self-help book tells you to do, right? Like every self-help book these days is telling you that you need to love every single aspect of yourself and never say a single negative thing about yourself. Shadow work, on the other hand, says every person is complex and we all contain multitudes. We all contain bad and good. And when we reject the bad, it actually has a habit of getting out of control. Carl Jung, you probably know that famous quote, which is, what you resist will not only persist, but will grow in size. That's what happens when we try to pretend that aspects of us don't exist, when we judge aspects of ourselves, when we try to push them down or push them away. They tend to grow in size. To be fair, shadow work is very new to me, but already I can feel it shifting my headspace. I have created a 4-day shadow work track on Intention, my app, so you can download that using the show notes. For me personally, I think that acceptance is the root of all change. If you are judging a part of yourself, it is just going to be so much harder to shift that part of yourself. And I see acceptance as non-judgment. A good place to start with shadow work would be to brainstorm on the question, like, what traits or what descriptive words would you hate to be used to describe you? So maybe you have a particular aversion to being called selfish or stingy or rude. The words that bring out the biggest emotional reaction are usually the words that you want to work on the most. Like for example, the word rude, if someone described me as rude, it just probably wouldn't trigger me so much. I wouldn't have a big emotional reaction to that because I don't associate too much with that trait. And even if I do have rudeness, I don't know, it's not a biggie. You'll notice that different negative words carry different energy. Some negative words will slide off you, like they won't affect you at all. And some negative words, you'll be like, ooh, like I would hate to be called that. Those are the words that you want to work on. Shadow work is all about being able to say, I am selfish. I am rude. Or a more gentle approach might be, sometimes I am selfish or sometimes I am rude. So you want to actually identify times in your life where you have been rude or selfish or whatever your word is. We have all demonstrated all of the traits, and to pretend that we haven't is denial. Another part of this is thinking about the good parts of those traits. Like most typically bad traits can be good in some scenarios. Like Ellen Langer said in my interview with her, inconsistency can be viewed as spontaneity. Stubbornness can be viewed as integrity. Like there is a good side of every single one of these negative descriptors. If this is something that you want to dive deeper on in the recs of the week, I'll have a book recommendation. Also, if you want to be super guided on it, I have a intention shadow work course that you can do over the matter of a couple of days. I definitely used to be in the camp of like, no, I can never think anything bad about myself. I always need to think that I'm just like wonderful and amazing and just think I'm incredible, because I guess that's what you see and like what you're told that you should do. But the more I should it on myself in that way, the less mentally healthy you tend to be. Most people that are super mentally healthy like aren't constantly trying to convince themselves that every part of them is amazing and okay, you know? The most mentally healthy people that I have met, firstly, like don't think about their negative traits that much, but also like have kind of come to terms with them and have a decent relationship with them. And that's what shadow work is all about. Idea number three. So I'm going to share a kind of dumb memory of myself when I was younger to demonstrate this next tool. And this was a memory that used to actually pop into my head all the time. And when you hear it, you're going to be like, really? But yes. When I was in grade four, I can remember there was a bench and it was full of all of these ants, like ants galore, more ants than you could imagine. And as you can picture, there was a bunch of people in grade four that were just like giggling, having a jolly old time, you know, pointing at these ants and making a fuss. And I was amongst those little grade fourers, and I decided to impulsively jump up onto the bench and start jumping on these poor little ants for no other reason than I was in a giggly mood and vibes were right. I was swept up in the energy. Then a teacher ran up to me. I think she grabbed me and she was like, "What is wrong with you? They are just ants. Why would you do that to them? What did they ever do to you?" Weirdly, that memory did stick with me for years. Like it would flash back into my mind. I clearly was a sensitive kid. And whenever I would think about it, I'd feel like a bad person. And I'm talking up to my early 20s. I probably wasn't super conscious of it when the memory would flash back. It was more just like a feeling that came alongside it. Then one day I discovered a process called imagery rescripting. Now, usually this is used for people who have PTSD. This is used for people who have recurring nightmares. It's used for people who have very real trauma, but it is also used for people who have social anxiety that tend to have a lot more imagery-based memories of being rejected when they were younger, which is why I wanted to use it in the first place. And I decided, you know, why not? Let's use imagery rescripting on this memory. I'm pretty sure this is one of the very first memories that I tried to rescript. And I'll explain what rescripting is in a second. But when I did this imagery rescripting process, my relationship with that memory completely shifted. Like it tangibly shifted. You could feel the difference within like a 30-minute period, because that's about how long imagery rescripting can take. Honestly, probably a shorter period of time too. From then, I have gone on to use this technique for so many different memories, and each time I am shocked by how much it has transformed my relationship with these memories. Sometimes you need to do it, you know, more than once if it's like a deeply entrenched memory, but every single time it tends to help. If you've ever heard of EMDR therapy, which is like, I think, trauma reprocessing, rapid eye movement therapy or something, it's in a similar category to that. I'm pretty sure that the effects of imagery rescripting aren't as strong as EMDR, but there's still a lot of evidence behind imagery rescripting. You probably just have to do a little bit more. So I'm going to give you some general steps for how you can apply imagery rescripting at home. One thing I will say is don't do this for, you know, deeply traumatic memories at home without the supervision of a therapist and a trained professional. I've used this on memories like, you know, social rejection as a kid, being left out, weird memories about ants, things that didn't cause me like shock or that weren't catastrophic. And I don't think that you should use this process on any of the above if you don't have a trained professional saying, yep, that's cool to do. So step number one is you want to actually re-experience the memory as a kid. This is hard in itself, but it's about activating the feelings and thoughts that you associate with the memory. And you need to activate those feelings and thoughts, otherwise you can't really transform the memory. Step number two, watch that memory again, but from your current self's perspective. So, if it's a memory of you as a kid jumping on ants, I would be watching that as my 28-year-old self. 29, oh my God. You can also add another layer to this to create a little more separation, which is watch it as if you're watching a movie. This is a bit more acceptance and commitment therapy. I know way too much about therapies. I got really into it for a period there. If it's a really like stingy memory and you're like, wow, there's just so much emotion here, I would also try watching it from your older self's perspective, but seeing everyone in the memory as a cartoon character. It sounds really dumb, I promise you, it makes a difference. Then step number three, as your older self, you are actually going to change the memory. So usually you'd pick a new meaning for the memory. For example, if it was a memory of bullying, you would pick a new meaning of the bully felt really small and this was just to make him feel bigger. And then you would make changes accordingly. So you might shrink the bully to the size of a mouse. It's truly as if you have a magic wand, you can do whatever you want. This is not about like gaslighting yourself. It's about changing the meaning of the memory. It's about changing the relationship you have with the memory. That's all that you're doing here. Then step number four, you re-experience the memory with all of the changes that you made as your younger self. Watch your older self make all of those changes. And then if you need, you can ask your older self for help or ask your older self for comfort. If you were like, you know, you've just gone through that so quickly, I couldn't possibly apply that at home, I need guidance. There are so many resources online. Just look up imagery rescripting. Also on the Intention app, it's called memory rescripting because that was a little bit clearer, but it will walk you through the process step by step so you can do it on your own and it'll give you a lot more guidance. Tool number four. So Lawrence J. Cohen, he shares the story of his eighth grade science experiment. His mom directed a nursery school and every spring they would hatch little chicks and he got to take those chicks home at night and over the weekends he got to look after them. His sister was studying psychology at the time, so she talked about tonic immobilization. Basically, chickens would play dead if they thought an eagle was nearby because they know an eagle's not going to eat a dead chicken. So when the chicks were a few days old, he actually tried to immobilize them and he tried to act like a hawk, like stare them in the eyes and see if it happened as part of this eighth grade science experiment. And it worked. One little chick stayed immobilized for about a minute. Then he tried immobilizing both of the little chicks. They stayed immobilized for 5 whole minutes. Then he tried immobilizing one, but he had the other one in the exact same box so that the immobilized one could see the other one moving around. It was only immobilized for a few seconds because it could see that the other one was happy, healthy, walking around, no danger. So it popped up pretty quickly. So his conclusion was that if the chick could see that the other chick wasn't scared, it was way quicker to pop up. Actually, his sister's professor found that chickens, when they looked themselves in the mirror and saw like another scared chicken, that would be when they were immobilized for the longest, which I thought was really interesting because they see their mirror image as another scared chicken. And kids actually do the same thing. So Lawrence Cohen, who shared that chick story, he is really clear with parents of kids with anxiety that you need to stop reassuring your kids with logic and facts. Because when you do that, you present yourself as kind of like a scared chicken. Words and logic do not soothe anxiety, particularly in children. And they can actually feed it because they don't imply confident assurance. Your kid needs you to stay strong because otherwise you are the scared chicken. He actually tells parents to look their kids in the eyes and say, look me in the eyes and do I look like I am scared? Which does apparently work a lot better than saying, you know, there's no need to be scared. It's not going to hurt you. You'll be okay. And when I started treating my emotions in a very similar way, everything kind of shifted for me. A while ago, I got really into emotional regulation, how to deal with my emotions. And honestly, I went through so much bad advice that made regulating my emotions just so much more difficult. A lot of the advice around feelings, I think either I misinterpreted or it probably just wasn't presented in the best of ways. Because a lot of the advice would say, you know, reassure yourself and be like, you're going to be okay. It's okay to feel this way. You're sad. That's normal. Like there was a lot around reassuring yourself. And none of that is necessarily bad if it's done with confident assurance. But the energy that I carried when I would say these things to myself was not that of confident assurance. I was the scared chicken. I was the unconfident parent to myself. If that analogy doesn't resonate with you, another analogy that I have shared around this is the one of the kid falling over. So if a kid falls over, they have a little stumble that's not like super painful or anything. They will immediately look to their parent and be like, what's up? How should I feel right now? Should I be anxious? Should I be panicking? Should I be wailing? And how their parent reacts totally will determine their response to their stumble. You see this in kids all the time. If their parent reacts and goes like, hey, you good? Confident assurance, doesn't panic. The kid also reacts with confident assurance and they just keep on going. If their parent is panicking, going like, oh my God, are you okay? Is everything all right? It's okay. It's just a little scratch. Like you're going to be fine. The kid is freaking out. They're going to wail. And the same goes with your emotions. If you to yourself are like, oh my God, are you going to be okay? Like, is everything all right? If you're panicking internally about your own emotions, you are going to find it much harder to emotionally regulate. I do have a whole podcast episode on emotional regulation. I could talk about it for days, but I won't. I'll direct you towards that podcast episode. It'll be in the show notes. But that is definitely one of the self-help tools that has helped me more than anything these past few years. And idea number five. So Jennifer Lawrence once did this lie detector test. I think it was for Vanity Fair. And in it, she was asked this question that's a pretty classic question. You know, if you had the ability to redirect a speeding train, would you redirect it to hit one person or let it flow into a group of 20 people? She answered, and then she was like, you know, every time I'm on the subway, I actually think about pushing people on the tracks. Like, I would never do it. I don't get tempted to do it, but it does cross my mind. What she just described is actually an intrusive thought, and we all have them. It's a pretty common one. Some people have them more than others, but notice how she reacted to that intrusive thought. She wasn't like, oh God, am I gonna push someone in front of a train? Am I a bad, violent person for having that thought? She didn't go out of her way to avoid train stations for the rest of her life, thank goodness, which is why she did not go on to develop OCD or a severe anxiety disorder. Instead, she had an intrusive thought and then she went, that was dumb, and she didn't think about it again. But it's interesting that with other thoughts outside of these like very stark intrusive thoughts, we treat them much more differently. Like we treat them like they are so serious. We try to change them. We make them mean something. Jennifer Lawrence let go of that intrusive thought because she had really healthy metacognitive beliefs. Metacognitive beliefs are basically beliefs about your thoughts and feelings. So here are some examples of metacognitive beliefs that could very quickly ruin your life if you held on to them. Number one, I cannot do anything to stop worrying or rumination. There's nothing I can do to influence or control myself if I am worrying or ruminating. Number two, certain thoughts are dangerous or bad, like thoughts about pushing someone in front of a train. Number three, all of my thoughts actually mean something about me. Number four, my thoughts are me. And here are some metacognitive beliefs that can quickly improve your life. I can't control my thoughts and feelings, but I can control how I react to them. The more you ruminate on a negative thought, the more power you give it. Thoughts are just events that happen in your brain. They're not really you. You can never get stuck in a thought or feeling. They all will fade. The thoughts you have when you are in a bad mood aren't actually reliable, and you shouldn't really pay too much attention to them. The way that you change these beliefs is just like the way that you would change any negative belief. You would look for the evidence because there are evidence for all of those healthy metacognitive beliefs. This is definitely derived from metacognitive therapy, which is a form of therapy that's a little less popular, but it's made a radical difference for me. I personally would love to make a whole podcast episode about metacognitive therapy because it's had such an impact on my life. Let me know if that's something that you want. It'd be very specific, but you know, there may be one person that's like, please give me that episode. So now that I have shared these tools that have made such a big difference for me, I want to talk Recs of the Week. Every ep, I give Recs of the Week that help you to dive deeper into the topics that I talked about in this episode, starting with recommendation number one, The Dark Side of Light Chasers, which is a whole book about shadow work. I will say up front, I don't agree with everything in this book. Like some of the things she says, I'm like, I don't know about that. However, if you want a place to start when it comes to shadow work, this is a great resource. Like I still really enjoyed the book, don't get me wrong. There are some bits and bobs that I was like, I don't know. I, for a long time, just had no idea where to start when it came to shadow work. I was like, everyone's talking about this. What does it actually mean? This book is definitely like your field guide. And the second rec of the week is Metacognitive Therapy by Linda Berlin. I do think that this might be a book for therapists. I don't know though. I could be wrong. Anyways, it is a great resource to start you with. It's not like a textbook. It's not super hard to read. But if you were interested in the metacognitive beliefs that I talked about at the end of this episode, you'll really enjoy that book. And it really gives you like a basis for how to start with metacognitive therapy. Your mini move of the week to help you to implement what was discussed in this podcast episode is try out a very tiny version of memory rescripting. I can actually walk you through it right now. Pick a memory, something light that still stings a little. Re-experience it as a child, just to evoke the feelings and thoughts that come alongside it so that you can shift it. Then you want to go ahead and view that memory from your current self's perspective, but put it on a TV and turn everyone in that memory into TV characters and make some changes to protect your younger self or just to change the meaning of that memory. Then go ahead and re-experience the memory as your younger self. See those changes happening. Ask for any additional changes to be made. That is a very short and sweet version of it. But I really encourage you to just try it out, like after you listen to this podcast episode. This has been such a shifter for me. Like it was one of those tools, but when I tried it for the first time, I was like, whoa, that was wild. Like I can't believe that that was something I could do on my own. It felt very much like I had just paid for high quality therapy. Once again, do not use it on anything that's genuinely traumatic or catastrophic. I appreciate you so very much. I hope that you liked this podcast episode, and I'll see you in the next one.